I'm Hannah Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Review of African Political Economy, which is a journal in the UK that I chair, which gives a radical approach to African politics and social processes. So that's really the basis of my knowledge, but my current research is more focused on the imperial core. So I'll explain more. And what I'm talking about now is a book project, and I'm really interested in kind of testing out the ideas because it's really rooted in the UK context. I have sort of presented it in Berlin, and I'm trying to get a more global idea of how the left approaches migration. I'm just going to time myself so I don't get carried away. Okay, we're going to try and talk for 10 to 15 minutes each. So the book project I'm talking about is on migration beyond capitalism. And its aim is to understand and intervene in left debates around migration and to advance a socialist approach. So that's the explicit aim of the book. And the context is that there's been the largest wave of migration to Europe since the Second World War in 2015, known as the Long Summer of Migration. And there's also been the narrow victories, again in the mid-2010s, for Brexit and Trump, which are strongly associated with anti-immigrant movements. But at the same time, there's been a surge of progressive social movements and parliamentary inroads for socialism, as neoliberalism has fallen into crisis and its hegemony is punctured, if not its power. So my earlier research was on the relationship between migrants, borders and global capitalism. And the research was really very far removed from popular and academic narratives on migration. So the question of what is to be done seemed impossible when I completed that research. But because there has been this opening up of political space, you know, in the context of that kind of crisis, then the what is to be done question can now be addressed. And that's what I'm trying to do. So my main context or frame of reference is the UK. But yes, I'm trying to talk more about what happens among the left in the imperial centre. So I'm drawing a lot of comparison between the UK, Germany and the US. So there is a consensus among the left, or at least an appetite for opening up borders and for fighting the dehumanisation of migrants. But the book argues that there are two problems preventing this radical change. One of them is that there is a danger of socialist politics ignoring migration regimes or taking them for granted and reproducing them. So ideas of things like universal basic income and services, a reformed welfare state or luxury communism, all of this could bring a kind of exclusionary nationalism if it ignores, migrant labour. And also there's a problem that sympathetic migration approaches, so often where there is a focus on migration, it can reify patterns of displacement and cheap labour in processes of accumulation which have underpinned capitalism through its successive periods of slavery, colonial labour regimes, post-war reconstruction and neoliberal labour flexibility. So what's developed is a kind of binary of pro and anti-migration approaches and assumptions that a criticism of the migration regime also amounts to anti-immigrant politics. But pro-migration politics can also reinforce the separation between migrants and native workers by focusing on migrants' usefulness and isolating them from the wider labouring classes. So, you know, a pro-migration approach can often focus on migrants as a kind of resource for the economy. So, in this sense, left narratives of migration are contradictory. What you see, at least in the UK, is humanitarianism, which is also combined with capitalist economic liberalism. And this economic liberalism undermines humanitarianism by focusing on abstract growth, while this growth is historically dependent on the exploitation of land and resources and on cheap, unfree labour. So the core question behind the book is what kinds of political alliances, programmes, policies and arguments do and do not work in the interests of global worker solidarity and progression out of cheap labour as a mainstay of wealthy economies. So in the book, there's a particular focus on Marxist correspondence on the Irish question. So this has been picked up by many researchers of migration and also racism recently, because it offers an understanding of the connections between imperialism, the eviction and emigration of populations, the suppression of wages and working conditions, and how the ruling class then intensifies antagonism. So this seems to be very relevant today for what's happening in the West and elsewhere. It's significant for understanding racism and the rise of the right, and also to looking beyond capitalism. And I think that it can advance a reconfiguration of the debate to move beyond hand-wringing and utopianism, connecting different struggles, and it offers a method and strategy for addressing the question of migration. So the aim of the book is to unpack all of these parts, but in this brief time, I'm going to discuss some of the underlying theory and relevance. So just to elaborate a bit more on what Marx said on the Irish question, so this was a letter that he wrote in 1870 to German-American correspondents in New York. So I like to have this connection today. So he'd submitted resolutions to transform Ireland into a free, fair and equal federation with Great Britain. And to summarise his argument, what he said in the letter was that English capital is turning Ireland into pasture land to obtain meat and wool at the cheapest possible prices. The Irish population is therefore evicted, and then the surplus labour goes to England, and this is of even more value to the bourgeoisie than the meat and wool. This forces down wages and it lowers the position of the English working class, and then there's a division into two hostile camps. So the English worker feels himself to be a member of the ruling nation and harbours religious, social and national prejudices which strengthen the dominion of the domination of the ruling class and capitalists over himself. And the Irishman sees the English worker as an accomplice and tool of English rule in Ireland. And he also drew comparisons in the letter with slaves in the US and the white workers in the US. So this antagonism was then artificially and knowingly kept alive and intensified by the press and the comic papers and all means at the disposal of the ruling classes. And this was the secret of the maintenance of power by the English ruling class and the secret of the weakness of the working class. So the priority for labour organising is to make English workers realise that for them the national emancipation of Ireland is not a question of abstract justice or humanitarian sentiment, but the first condition of their own social emancipation. And it's also the only way to upend the ruling class. So overall, it's an anti-imperialism argument. And just to quickly illustrate how the ruling class was intensifying antagonisms, the Greater London Council in 1984 published a volume on the roots of anti-Irish racism in England, which showed the barbarism of colonial rule and the kind of scientific racism underpinning it, which declared at the time that the Irish were a different race to the people of central and eastern England. And Irish workers were aware of this game. So a letter to the Irish Times, for example, said that Britain has long been a capitalist and imperialist country. Its rulers have always had a vested interest in trying to justify their plunder and oppression in Ireland and to divide and rule the workers of different nationalities in Britain. So on successive occasions, when the Irish people sought to resist British rule, the anti-Irish joke appeared in Britain, and this humour always served the purpose of confusing the ordinary public in Britain and preventing them from appreciating that the Irish people had a just cause. The jokes helped the British government lie on Northern Ireland, sustaining the story that the war is a religious one with people who are inferior and don't have a logical reason for behaving as they do. And you can draw comparisons between, you know, the kind of narrative of, you know, workers from Mexico and Latin America in the United States. So Marx introduces his analysis in the Irish question by saying that he's come to the conclusion that the decisive blow against the ruling classes in England, and this is decisive for the workers' movement all over the world, can't be struck in England, but only in Ireland. And the overthrow of the English aristocracy in Ireland would entail and would bring about the prerequisites for the proletarian revolution in England. So it's much broader, therefore, than defending migrants. It's also about the liberation of territories and of workers in both oppressing and oppressed nations. And he noted how the Irish question was also dividing workers from between Britain and the US. So globalisation and borders are the newcomers to this far-reaching relationship between imperialism and migration. Migration is diversified, and borders and immigration regimes, as we know them, are less than a century old. So now we have effectively a global apartheid-type system, which reproduces north-south inequality and is central to poverty in the global south. So borders have become the core focus of migration politics for their proliferation, their violence, and their articulation with labour regimes. But the struggle expands also to the cognitive border, that makes it almost inconceivable to unite the interests of different groups of workers from highly unequal nations and parts of the world and to move beyond this kind of hierarchical construction. So in the EU's own mythology, Lenin and Hobson's argument that there would be a kind of United States of Europe, which would not further the cause of world civilization, is turned on its head as the formation of the EU is its central logic is really that those from outside the EU are kind of a threat to its civilization. So it has one of the most repressive immigration regimes. So I don't think I even have time to go into wage rates, but perhaps to cover a little bit, because they're a key part of Marx's analysis of the Irish question. They're a part of the puzzle. And while there are often fears or assumptions that discussion of lowered working conditions is going to conflate with anti-migrant hostility and will intensify xenophobia on the native working class. Hello. What particularly studies from, many studies from the US, from the left especially, have shown that this conflation doesn't have to happen. So in kind of avoiding questions of cheap labour, there's often an underestimation of people's understanding. And also there's the problem that the argument needs to be politicised in the sense that migration has often been depoliticised in neoliberal governance with elite policing of the debate, which often marginalises socialist labour centres' positions and conflates them with anti-immigrant politics. So this kind of conflation does happen in reality. So there's been a blue labour tendency in the UK and also elements of Die Linke in Germany as well, which do conflate a kind of labour-centred position on migration with an argument that borders should be closed to avoid it. And that kind of constrains migration policy to a utopianism of rights, you know, which is utopian in the sense that it's impossible in the present historical conjuncture without systemic change, or a kind of pragmatism of controls. So social democracy kind of balances these rights and controls, but don't address the class antagonisms which are at the root of the problem. So, in the post-war era, state regulation sort of prevented undercutting of wages, and there was a lot more discussion of cheap labour. And this analysis of migrant labour serves as a basis for solidarity with and among precarious and low-paid workers who are not benefiting from the macroeconomic stability that they're creating. So key to a migration approach which is progressive, I think, is the understanding that economic growth, the productivist logic, is at the same time destroying the conditions of nature and labour, and it's an abstract focus which is best mitigated by the kind of labour-centred approach which is promoted by scholars like Ben Selwyn, but also, you know, my co-panelists, which is why I'm really pleased that we've been put together. So, I really want to wrap up, especially because we started late, so I hope I've been as coherent as possible. I just have another minute or so, and then we'll open it, you know, we'll have more discussion after. But in questioning with this kind of basis, the discussion of imperialism, wages, and you know a kind of internationalist approach, then going to Luxembourg in her criticism of the Bolsheviks, she emphasised that socialism cannot work on a national level, So this is why I really want to emphasise that an understanding of cheap labour should never draw the conclusion that you increase, you know, the kind of repression of migrants. This has no logic, you know, by Marx's analysis or Rosa Luxemburg's. So Luxemburg emphasised that socialism can't work nationally. There should be avoidance of any arguments from the left that migration is a benefit to the nation, that it brings growth. This is unhelpful, because this is the other side of the coin to arguments that migrants should be kept out. So both are nation-centric, while the state and the national economy have become detached in neoliberal states from the interests of ordinary workers. So this is to talk about the relationship between migration and growth is to defend the interests of the ruling class. So what the Irish question also brings, I'll try and wrap up, is you know, the recognition of power of capitalist interest in politics, media and academia, which are attacking public life and reinforcing social relations, and to resist this by seeking a narrative from the workers' perspective, which does show the kind of unity and solidarity which I'm talking about. So despite the ruling class's efforts to divide people, history instead always shows grassroots actions of solidarity when undercutting happens. For example, between Jewish and Irish workers, you know, striking in the 1930s, or between Mexican and US workers in many cases, for example, in the meat industry. So, you know, it means expanding on the anti-imperialist tendency in bourgeois society. Internationalism is not necessarily progressive, but it is when it's explicitly anti-imperialist. So developing an understanding of the national question is key. And my main conclusion is going from the book is going to be that we need to move from a discourse of freedom of movement to equality of movement to level the playing field. So I'm going to leave it there, and then we'll go on to Nat.
Hi everyone, kia ora mai tātou. My name's Nat, and I'm in the fourth year of my PhD at the University of Auckland in New Zealand in the South Pacific. I haven't really prepared. I have four lines to read off, in part because I feel like now that I'm in the fourth year of my PhD, I've been giving the same talk for a number of years, circulating around some of the same issues, which is a really good incentive for me to finish my PhD, because then I can start talking about something else. But so what I want to look at is, or talk to you today about, is the consequences of logistical economic restructuring from the 1950s and 60s onwards, and an expanded understanding of the strike as a tactic and what that means when we move beyond the kind of limited idea of the striking wage labourer in that very specific context. So as a bit of a background, just going to make a note of the time. So the logistics revolution describes this process from the 1960s, roughly, where you have large-scale economic restructuring of industrial centres. So moving away from sort of the Fordist factory model and using the new technological capacities offered by the shipping container and cybernetic theory and computational capacity to distribute production around global sites of labour and extraction. So the consequences of that, there's kind of different theories around what motivated that, but one of them is the organised power of labour in industrial centres, right? So the ability of workers to have leveraged their power and their ability to go on strike and to refuse the conditions of exploitation, to both increase their wages, better their conditions, and achieve legislative reform that massively constrained the power of capital. So this is often associated with a crisis in productivity, a crisis in profitability. So rather than an economic crisis triggered by overproduction or declining rates of value, it's that capital has kind of exhausted its ability to make more efficient or productive or exploitative those conditions of labour in a particular place. So what the logistical strike then looks at doing is, instead of a strike of workers by refusing to produce value by withdrawing their labour, right? So instead of going tools down in a factory context, a logistical strike seeks to intervene or disrupt the process of circulation or broader context of social reproduction in order to capture or halt values movement. Looking at this in a Marxist sense, I guess, basically it's looking at how to capture value in its commodity form and create an untenable distance between its realization and its production, right? So rather than allowing the sale of commodities, where it then takes on its the money form, it's realized its value, you can disrupt that movement rather than just refusing to produce it in the first instance. So that's kind of the general theoretical thrust there. So my research in particular is looking at port blockades as a tactic. And so I focused on Oakland, on the west coast of the United States, and Newcastle, which is just Newcastle, Australia, just north of Sydney. So I just want to give a little bit of context around some of the blockade actions in those contexts, and then look at some of the limits and consequences that I'm working through, and I guess I'm interested in people's feedback or thoughts on some of the directions and consequences in that area. So in Oakland, I guess people will probably be most familiar with the West Coast port shutdown and the general strike that happened during Occupy Oakland in 2011. I also spoke to some activists who were involved in the Block the Boat for Gaza campaign, which was a 6-day rolling blockade outside of the port in order to stop any offloading or distribution of goods that were coming off the Israeli Zim ship. So using a port blockade as a means to implement BDS tactics and stopping or boycotting Israeli goods by physically stopping their distribution rather than just at the point of consumption outside stores and doing consumer boycotts. And in Newcastle is the world's largest coal exporting port. So they export 1 million tons of coal per day. And for the last 10 years, Australian environmental activists have been involved with both doing sabotage of machinery of extraction and distribution. So that's both going into the coal mines and sabotaging equipment there, locking onto train lines and understanding the distributive networks that are used of getting all of the coal to the port terminal, and water-based flotillas of actually going out in front of coal ships and physically stopping them. So these are kind of some of the tactics that look at choke points or bottlenecks in infrastructural networks. So one of the stories that's told about logistics is that it has this system of flexibility. It's a way to undermine and circumvent organized forms of resistance and refusal. And it has this incredible ability to reconfigure itself around points of disruption or resistance. But one of the kind of consequences of this is that despite the fact that it has this reconfigurable ability to distribute itself and reconfigure itself, there's these absolutely necessary and inescapable pinch points within that infrastructure, right? So if you have outsourced production in any capacity, you have to have a port. You have to have some point of material connection between these places. And so basically these tactics are looking at where, in the context where the sort of historical concept of a strike has been largely undermined and made ineffective in its ability to genuinely leverage power, whether it be because it's so legislatively constrained that striking is only legal and very, you know, when you're in industrial bargaining and in good faith, or so whether it's that sort of legalistic sense, or in the sense where there are high rates of unemployment, the nature of work has changed, people are on flexible or incredibly exploitative contracts that mean that their individual power to resist is compromised as well. So then looking at where are the opportunities or possibilities of leveraging power today, if not in the factory, if not in the context of your wage labour. And so one of the sort of consequences of that in terms of subjectivities of resistance that I'm really interested in here is that blockading these disrupting these sites of infrastructure and distribution doesn't require that you do so as a worker. So you can disrupt, destroy, compromise capital's trajectory of value without that being constrained to your particular waged relation with capital in that context. So I guess one of the consequences of this, or one of the things that I'm thinking through, is when I first started looking into this tactic, it seemed like this kind of incredible alternative in the context where the strike is kind of so ineffective and limited today. But then looking into sort of some of the empirical consequences of it, it actually still remains a temporary symbolic form of disruption, and its effect on capital is not as significant as we kind of otherwise imagine. And so I kind of have two examples of this. People might be familiar with the 2002 lockout at LA Long Beach. So LA Long Beach is the largest megaport complex in the United States. It brings in about 50% of all imported goods into the United States, which are then distributed across the intermodal train system. And so the 2002 lockout was lasted 10 days, and that was estimated to have cost $2 billion per day in lost revenue by shutting down that port complex. And then the Taft-Hartley Act was invoked in order to force the workers back into the port complex, or to force the PMA, the Pacific Maritime Association, which is the kind of conglomerate of all of the employers on the port, ports on the West Coast, to return to negotiations. So, and that's the first time that the Taft-Hartley Act was used, invoked against an employer lockout rather than a union strike, if you're interested in that. But when you actually look at the costings of where that $2 billion per day, right, so the idea of this $20 billion threat to the US economy, that number was actually massively inflated in order to for the PMA to leverage their ability to force the workers back to work without having to concede on their lockout, basically. So if you look at the costing of where this $2 billion figure came from, it kind of assumes that all of the commodities that would have come into the port in those 10 days just disappeared, which isn't true. So car ferries, for example, a car that's 10 days delayed in its delivery hasn't had any of its value compromised, it's just 10 days late. Or fresh produce, for example, can be rerouted from being sold as fresh produce to be turned into canned goods or fruit juices or these kind of things. So both there's the ability to salvage and repurpose a lot of those commodities. But there was also, interestingly, this happened in October, which is usually when you have the highest rate of imports into a country, ready for the Christmas sales or increased consumption. But large corporations, or the largest importers, such as Walmart and Target, shifted their sales into August because they kind of closely watch what's happening in terms of the union, port unions and employer negotiations. So they actually preempted their ability to leverage the market in their favour, means that they massively preempted and brought goods in prior to this. And so there was actually competitive advantage for large employers in the fact that this lockout happened. In Newcastle, as another example of some of the limits or contradictions, because they widely advertise and try to get large community involvement in blockading the container ships, the coal ships, the port authorities actually condense and increase the number of ships coming through the day after and the day before the blockades happen. So they actually ended up exporting more coal in that week than they would have if activists hadn't intervened or done anything. So these are kind of some of the the limits or contradictions that I'm thinking through to then think what would it mean to be able to genuinely disrupt or seize this infrastructure without having these consequences immediately emerge around how that can just be leveraged, how that disruption can then be absorbed, made profitable for capital again. And then you kind of, things go back to normal the next day, right? So there's been this moment of disruption, but it hasn't actually really compromised value. So there's kind of an ongoing question of the ability to scale that disruption and extend it over a longer period of time to the point where it would be genuinely destabilizing for capitalist production.
Okay, everyone. First of all, I want to apologize for being late. This, of course, has nothing to do with, you know, like a people of color time issue on my side. It has to do with the subway and the cuts to it, okay? Just to make that clear. So my name is Jimena Bustamante. I am a member of the International Women's Strike New York City and also a member of the Democratic Socialist of America, specifically of the Socialist Feminist Working Group. So, you know, like, we have like some invisible curator who is not present here that put all of us in the same table. And what I was asked to speak about is the experience of organizing for the women's strike. And I've been hearing that there are like a lot of resonances with some of the topics that the other panelists touch upon. So what I would like to do today is focus my presentation in like 2 points. One is, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the story of the women's strikes in the recent years. Well, I don't know if you already know about it, but I'm going to tell you anyway. And, you know, like, in telling you this sort of, like, brief story, I'm going to outline what I think are some of the tensions and the open questions that bringing together women and a strike, you know, like, produce as, you know, like, two sort of, like, terms that come from different vocabularies and different genealogies of struggle. And the other thing that I want to do is focus a little bit on the story of organizing the women's strike to the extent that it has been possible in the United States, specifically in New York, and highlight why is it that I think that if we pay attention to that experience, we can see that despite how gloomy the sort of like horizon can seem, you know, like here, we can identify like some processes that have occurred in other countries. And it seems to me that there are like some historical resonances, you know, like between what is happening here and in other spaces that can tell us about what is to come, let's say. So let me go into first, you know, like the recent history of the women's strikes. And I emphasize the recent part because, you know, like it's a kind of like long history, and also I'm choosing like a rather arbitrary point to start, right? So in 2016, there were a couple of like women's strikes that make headlines around the world. One happened in Poland, which, you know, like you probably heard about. And over there, basically, you know, like the legislation around abortion was very restrictive. And there was a proposal by, you know, a conservative government to completely ban all abortions and to criminalize the practice of abortion. So the women's strike in Poland actually emerged as a response to that. I guess that one of the things that are like that is very interesting about what happened in Poland is that political strikes are forbidden, and also just like in general there are also sort of restrictions, so, like legal leave to strike, just to follow up on what you were saying. But they had this mechanism of being able to call sick certain number of times, you know, per year. So basically this is what women did, right? Like many of them called sick. And this basically became the biggest mobilization since the fall of the wall in Poland, right? In terms of numbers, but also in terms of how spread it was, how many cities in Poland took part of it. So while that happened in Poland, in Argentina, a movement that had been growing through the years that we usually know, we know it as Ni Una Menos. It's a movement that has been fighting against violence towards women, but specifically around the issue of femicide. And, you know, like more recently, abortion has also become like one sort of like major battle, right? So in 2016, there was like this outrageous sort of like femicide of a teenager, and that sparked the first women's strike in Argentina. And these two happened in 2016, right? So after that happened, there was a conversation going on in different parts of the world about actually calling for an international women's strike. And in 2017, this actually sort of like became true. After the women's march here in the United States, the Argentinians seized the day and sort of like made use of the mediatic coverage that the women's march was getting in Argentina to sort of like basically put out an international call for a women's strike to be held on March 8th. That, as you probably know, is historically, you know, like a day of feminist mobilization around the world, not in the United States, but in most of the rest of the world. So they did that call, and many countries joined to the call for an international women's strike to happen March 8, 2017, right? And many countries actually had, you know, like a strike. After 2017, in 2018, there was again an international call for a women's strike, and new countries joined the strike, most notably the Spanish state, right? Where once again, millions of people and women came out to the street, and actually in the Spanish state, a series of unions supported the strike, right? Like, not what they call the majoritary unions, but the minoritary unions actually officially called for a strike. And then in 2019, once again, you know, like another international call for a women's strike. The countries that I already mentioned, all of them had like, sort of like, their own women's strike, Argentina, Spain, but new countries joined. For example, Chile, right? And in Chile, the numbers on the street were the biggest after the fall of the dictatorship. So you can see already a sort of like trend emerging here, right? Like, so I guess I would like to sort of like make a few points before going to the story of the United States in these 3 years. One is that, you know, like the contours of this movement is still on the making, right? But that the widespread character of the women's strike, I mean, how expanded it is geographically, tells us that there are a series of historical resonances between all these different localities and certain sort of traction in bringing together women and a strike as categories, but also as a histories of a struggle and sort of like a history of different tactics, right? And I believe that the reason why, one of the reasons why this combination of women and a strike is getting traction around the world, even though it's taking different forms in different localities, has to do with how pairing these two things speaks about transformations in global capitalism in the recent decades, and transformations in sort of like the configuration of labor, right? So I guess that it's important to note that, as I was saying before, that this is a movement that is widespread geographically, right? And probably it has a geographic kind of like dimension that we hadn't seen since the 60s. It has been called transnational. However, I would like to argue that it's more exact to call it translocal, because, you know, like the unit, let's say, of analysis shouldn't be the nation state. Most of what has been happening has been localized in cities within nation states, right? Even though some nation states have multiple cities participating, the women's strike in one single nation state can be very different from one city to the other. And this is what we have seen in the Spanish state or in Germany, this 2019, that Germany joined the women's strike. Also, it's becoming a movement that is one of like the most compelling alternatives to the rise of the global right, right? So I would like to then sort of like move to the history of what happened in New York and in the US. The first women's strike in New York specifically and in some cities of the US happened in 2017. As I was telling you, after the Argentinians saw the women's march, called for this strike, a group of people got together in New York and began planning for a women's strike here. The results were, of course, you know, very different than in the other countries. The legend says that two school districts closed in Virginia, right? Like, right, I mean, and I say the legend because besides the actual people organizing for the strike, just the whole theme of the women's strike got sort of like mediatically exposed by the Women's March, right? The Women's March sort of like joined the call for the women's strike and rebranded and called it A Day Without a Woman, and then they put all their mediatic machinery to work towards it, so that helped us a lot. It also had its sort of like setbacks, right? But that spread the call. So that happened in Virginia. In other places, there were like walkouts and just like marches. And the biggest march was in New York City, which again is not a huge march, you know, like a few thousands, but for an anti-capitalist feminist march, it was like a landmark, right? Like, at least in the US. So even if, you know, like the numbers were not very big, what I want to argue is that the kind of like, let's say, intervention that this meant in New York and in other cities had to do with precisely bringing up the conversation of the women's strike, right? Like, and putting together these two terms, right? Like, it was a kind of like political, like I said, opening, I would say. So what I've been trying to say all along is that, you know, like when you put women and a strike together, you can see that there's a tension going on there, right? That usually, you know, like the subject of the strike is supposed to be workers, right? Like, and you can put that as in workers within a workplace or within a sector or within multiple sectors, or even you can say the working class, right? But posing women as a subject of a strike, of course, produces, you know, like a series of openings, but also of like, let's say, contradictions, right? And it also means that there's an intervention. When you put these two things together, you are intervening feminist politics and you are also intervening in the politics of organized labor, right? So through the organizing process for March 8 in New York, it became possible to understand the task of articulating an actual women's strike as an attempt to inscribe labor and its tactics at the heart of a renewed feminist movement, right? And also sort of like in so doing, sort of like a few sort of like questions were opened up, right? First of all, what counts as labor, right? Second, you know, like what counts as class struggle? How we can think about different forms of a struggle, let's say like feminist struggle. And also, you know, like what should be like the transformations that should be at the core of a truly radical feminist politics. So the promiscuity implicit in bringing together women on a strike definitely presented a tactical challenge for feminists around the world, right? And the response to that tactical challenge, as I was saying, has been local, right? In each locality, there has been this question of how you bring these two things together, right? And the articulation of the strike, you know, like, has meant that in different localities, women have been like asking, what are the types of labor that women perform, right? What are the specific conditions of exploitation and domination that this labor faces? But also, how this labor can be withdrawn, right? And some of the most exciting conversations about that have been happening in the Spanish state. And like the questions of like who is the subject of the strike, meaning when unions are calling for a strike, is it for everyone? Is it only for women? What is the role of, you know, like men in the strike? How the stopping of care should happen, right? Since we know that care, I mean, someone has to care, right? Like, so then who cares, you know, like when there's a women's strike, right? Like, so all these questions, you know, like have been opened up by this juxtaposition of, you know, like women and a strike and by its articulation in practice. You know, like in New York, the group that organized the women's strike in 2017 and then 2018 and 2019, it has been a rather small group. So we really didn't have like the sort of like organizational capacity to actually make it a work stoppage, right? But many of these questions were actually on the table. So it seems to me that, you know, like it's important here to mention, you know, like the relation with the Women's March and the role that the Women's March has played also in making difficult actually having something as a women's strike or developing, you know, like this movement at the crossroads of gender and labor. As I was saying before, the Women's March kind of like was our equivalent to a massive demonstration as the ones that we saw in the Spanish state or Chile, etc. But with a different configuration, right? And oriented towards electoral politics, basically. So that means that they have sort of appropriated, you know, like the historical momentum, right? Like, and like they have been the ones setting the tone of what this women question is, right? And that's why the relation to the Women's March has always been like this contradictory thing in which the women's strike has been benefiting from the publicity and at the same time really conditioned to their terms, right? So, you know, like given these limitations, the sort of like organizational limitations that the women's strike face in New York, the shadow of the Women's March and its whole sort of like Democratic Party machinery, you know, like one organizational path that we decided to follow in 2018 was building a coalition. So the whole question was, how can we actually build the capacity for something as what we are seeing in the Spanish state or in Argentina to happen at some point in history, really? So we thought like, well, we should approach already organized entities, right? And bring them together under an anti-capitalist feminist banner. So what we did is, you know, like bring together low-wage workers organizations, which, as probably you know, are mostly composed by women, mostly by undocumented labor, right? And these sort of organizations organize people in sectors where unionization is like almost impossible, right? Like in care work sectors, in service sector, etc. Then, besides these low-wage workers organizations, we also attempted to organize with unionized labor, right? And, well, that's a whole other story of how difficult that is. So that's another part of the coalition. Also, many socialist groups sort of like got involved, right? Like feminists within socialist groups and community-based organizations. And some of the things that we began discussing in these coalition meetings was actually what brought people to the room. We had, you know, like people coming to the space that had never been sharing a space before, right? And the two questions that people were doing in these coalition meetings, the first one is, you know, like, what brings us together? We will sort of like present the platform of the Women's Strike, you know, like tell them about all this very nice sort of like discursive thing, right? Like, and then people will say, but okay, we agree with all this platform, but how is it that my struggle, let's say, as a street vendor, right, relates to the struggle of this person here that is coming from the retail union and relates to the struggle of the sex worker over there, right, or to, you know, like, I don't know, the restaurant worker, right? And people were saying, yeah, I mean, besides a general notion of social justice, how do we understand the relation between our struggles? So that was the first question. And the second question, and it was like a really burning one, is how are we different from sort of like this other feminism? And how should we call this other thing, right, that is embodied by the Women's March? And what I would like to argue is that the answer to those two questions is not pre-given, right, but it's actually results from the process of organizing together. So figuring out, you know, like where the overlaps are, right, and also where the contradictions, because this is something that we began discovering in the coalition work, that the retail union was bargaining against the street vendors, right, like things like that, right. So, you know, like it has been an ongoing process of figuring out where the overlaps are and where the contradictions are, and actually what makes us different from this sort of like neoliberal feminism, right? Let me see. I guess that one point that I want to make about what makes us different that I believe is very, very important is that a conversation that we've been having in the Women's Strike in New York and with different allies is that many people think that the differences are regarding positions about specific issues, right? So we have a position on X, and you know, like the Women's March has this other position. Therefore, we are the left, right? But the thing that we have been seeing is that, you know, like this neoliberal feminism can adapt itself very well, right? Like, and it changes positions. So the Women's March has moved to the left through a process that I will very sort of like quickly touch upon. And it has changed its position in a bunch of things. And then now, you know, like they have this platform that is like very progressive, at least in paper, right? So what I sort of like think that one of the things that we've been seeing through the process of organizing this anti-capitalist feminist coalition is that one major difference has to do with who is the subject of this new feminist movement, right? And I would like to argue that, you know, like our main difference has to do with first the fact that our subject is collective, right? that this other feminism, however you want to call it, understands itself as an amalgamation of individuals, right? That act together, but that's it, right? That have like sort of like their own sort of like incentives to operate, that are like utility maximizers, right? And that cooperate for specific things. And if we are going to succeed in creating anything like the women's strike in other places, it seems to me that one task is precisely creating sort of like this collective subjectivity, right? Like, and that's a sort of like a, something that is more easily said than actually done, right? And then this takes me to, you know, like what has been happening with the Women's March most recently. In 2019, as probably you heard, you know, like the Women's March suffered this like huge backlash, right? Precisely since from the beginning, all its politics has been oriented towards elections. After the midterm elections and the kind of like resurgence of the Democratic Party, this, what seems to me, internal battle within the Democratic Party took place to control the Women's March, right? And so far, the leadership of the Women's March has been in the Bernie camp, right? And it seems that there was like this very sort of like, I don't know, like, very sort of like a big concern among the establishment of the Democratic Party to take the control of the Women's March, right? So that in the elections of 2020, they could present a candidate like, I don't know, for example, Elizabeth Warren, and make her like the embodiment of, you know, like feminism, of the feminist movement, right? And say, you know, like Bernie and this other camp are, you know, like the sexist ones, right? So it was very important to control the Women's March in that sense. So, you know, like the Women's March had all these attacks, all these sort of like claims of, you know, like the leadership being anti-Semitic, also just a fight over the brand, right? Because it has become a brand. And the consequence is that there were far less people on the streets. So many people began saying, well, this shows that the feminist movement is kind of like on decline, you know, like very clearly, right? And what I would like to argue is that that's not the case, you know, like that we should sort of like pay attention to other indexes, not only how many women there are on the streets through the Women's March, right? And this takes me to the teacher strikes. And just to kind of like make sense of what I've been telling you, at the beginning, I told you that I believe that there are like a series of processes happening in the US that tells us that there are like resonances between what is going on here and what has happened in other countries. And it seems to me that the teacher strikes speak about that. Because when you bring together women and strike, you have to pay attention of what is happening with the feminist movement and its organizational forms, but you also have to pay attention to what is happening with organized labor, right? And this is a part of the story that is usually not touched upon when we hear about Argentina or Spanish state, what was happening within the unions, right? Or within sort of like other forms of organized labor that cannot be unionized. So, you know, like, I believe that how long, I mean, I don't know, since we don't have a moderator, I need someone to moderate me. So let me just say this, like, very briefly about the teacher strikes. You know, like, I guess that you know the story, so probably I shouldn't go to this whole thing that West Virginia and red states, and let's skip that. I just want to sort of, like, jump towards UTLA, right, and the sort of, like, fight in Los Angeles. And I just want to tell a very brief anecdote. Recently, I was in a talk by one of the members of the bargaining committee from UTLA, and I believe that both her personal trajectory and the story that she told to the crowd, it's an example of this, you know, like how there is a way in which organized labor is being transformed by engaging with battles that go beyond just like mere workplace concerns, right? By engaging in battles that we usually understand to be the realm of feminism, like, you know, transforming relations in everyday life. So she sort of like told this story about how she used to be the wife of a sort of like priest in a sort of like religious sect, right? And it was, you know, like in this religious sect, you know, like she kind of like learned a lot of like skills and sort of like also was subjectivized, I guess, you know, in certain form of like communal practice, right? But of course, you know, like this sect was very sort of like oppressive in terms of gender, right? And when she was in her 40s, she said, like, okay, fuck this, I'm gonna leave this husband and I'm gonna look, you know, for something else to do. And then she became a teacher. But she didn't got into the union immediately, so it's not this story of, you know, like, the union picks up these people and raises them, you know, like, in their union culture or something. But it's, you know, like, this woman began involved in coalition building work with organizations working against the criminalization of black youth, right, and youth of color. And through that community work, she actually got plugged in into the union, right? And then she became one of these, like, very key figures for the sort of, like, organization of, you know, like, the Radical Caucus of UTLA, and ultimately for the happening, like, the articulation of the strike. And, you know, like, one of the things that she was sort of, like, telling us is, she was emphasizing that for her the importance of what happened in Los Angeles had to do with to what extent the strike in Los Angeles, and before she thinks that the most important precedent was on Chicago, how the strike could actually push beyond the boundaries of what is understood as a worker's struggle, right? And how it could actually transform the sort of like conditions, learning conditions of the students, you know, like transform the relation between the community and sort of like the teachers, but also transform the sort of relation between teachers themselves and other workers in the school, right? She spoke about this sort of like widespread alienation, right, within the workplace, and how the strike completely, I mean, make people start just like talking to each other, right? Like, and understanding each other as part of one single, let's say, subject, right? So what I want to sort of like, and she was especially proud to say that their struggle, you know, like, was one of the broadest in terms of all the realms of collective experience that it set itself to transform, right? So I believe that this sort of like experience and the experience of other workers in care work sectors is speaking to us about the reciprocate relation I outlined earlier. You know, like I was saying before that the women's strike speaks about a process in which feminists appropriate a labor tactic, and in so doing, you know, like, they are transforming feminism, right? And I believe that what we are seeing with the teacher strikes, especially in the example of LA, is a process in which organized labor that has its own tradition of collective action and socios making practices is acting upon the realm of everyday life, and that acting upon that realm is transforming organized labor, right? You know, like, that's why I believe that, you know, like, the organized labor in sectors crucial to the care work economy are going to play a fundamental role in the becoming of this new feminism here in the US. And if we pay attention, you know, like, to what has happened in other countries, you know, like, in Argentina, there's something that people rarely speak about that is called the intersindical feminista, meaning a group of syndicalists in different unions, like women, that created this network outside of the traditional channels through which their unions are supposed to communicate and coordinate, right? Okay, oh, okay. So this means that I have to stop, but yeah, so I just wanted to say that this is happening in the US, that this is a sign that the movement, you know, like, is also alive here. And that's why the women's strike in 2019 focused on articulating together, articulating women in feminized and care work sectors. There's no time to tell you how we did that, but I just want to know that we did. And yeah, that's it. Thank you.